The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Well, hello there. This is Fred Brack, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. And for the next half hour, I'll be reading to you from Our State magazine. Today's reading of Our State is underwritten by the Carter Glass Insurance Agency, serving our community since 1974 and underwriting our podcast for over 15 years. They can be reached at 919-781-1973. And now we return once again to the December 2022 edition of Our State magazine, celebrating North Carolina. And you can imagine what the theme is this Christmas. Have yourself a merry little Christmas. And we're going to read a couple of articles here today, the first of which is entitled A Colonial Christmas. In New Bern, the historical interpreters at Tryon Palace invite visitors to immerse themselves in the holidays of the 1700s. And we have a colorful picture here of a gentleman who clearly loves his job. It says, each December, Tryon Palace brings the stories of North Carolina's colonial past to life during its candlelight Christmas event. Last year, the town crier, played by Ed Gagnon, welcomed guests into the inner courtyard. And this is a man dressed, as you might expect, in colonial gear. He's in front of a brick building in the background. He is dressed in a long robe, which is navy blue with red sleeves. And the sleeves have some little bells or buttons, I can't tell which it is, near the elbow portion of the sleeve, which is where the red ends and the blue begins. And he has underneath a long, long red vest. It goes down practically to his knees. It also has gold buttons on it. And he has a white scarf around his neck and a hat. I think it's called a tri-point hat. I'm not really sure. It's pointed in front and comes out to the side. And, of course, he has that big smile that I promised you. I think I see a modern wristwatch on his arm, though. And in his right arm, he is holding a candle-lit lantern. So let's get started. This article is written by Leah Hughes. As the Christmas season approaches, in 1770, Royal Governor William Tryon readies himself, his wife, and daughter, and their servants to move into Tryon Palace. On the banks of the Trent River in New Bern, the new palace will become the center for governmental affairs in the British colony of North Carolina and the home of its governor. On December 5th, 1770, Governor Tryon hosts a grand opening gala. As the sun sets to the west, darkness befalls the palace around 5 p.m. on these shortest days of the year. Servants light candles that illuminate and provide glimpses into the stately structure. The dining table, laden with meat pies, trifle, gingerbread, and punch, is set with reflective silver trays to maximize the glow of the flames. Supper begins late, perhaps at 10 p.m., and revelry continues into the wee hours of the morning. Attendees tip back glass after glass of rum as guests present toasts to honor the governor and his new abode. True stories from the past, such as Governor Tryon's first and only Christmas in the palace, serve as templates for today's beloved holiday tradition, Candlelight Christmas at Tryon Palace. Each year, staff members at the historic site write a different script for the event. When candlelight evening arrives, interpreters act out the storyline in first person, weaving attendees into the tale. When staff members meet in January to select the year's story, they search historical records for relatable characters. Someone looking to climb the social ladder. Someone who's made a mistake and is wrestling with what to do next. someone who wants a better life for his or her children. A lot of times when we learn history and sit through history classes, we're exposed to the big things like war and movers and shakers of the time, says Matt Arthur, who coordinates the Living History Program at Tryon Palace and authors the annual Candlelight Script. I try to find ways to help people make connections, to understand that our ancestors were people too. This year, the Candlelight Story, set in 1771, invokes Sarah Wilson, who comes from England and masquerades as Queen Charlotte's younger sister. Wilson convinces some of the colony's elite families to host her and throw parties in her honor. Well-to-do colonists fall harder for her trickery because they'll do anything to gain favor with the British crown. Servants and some guests are more dubious, and their suspicions pepper the evening with tidbits of gossip. Tryon Palace has an interesting perspective on history. Completed in late 1770 by acclaimed architect John Hawkes, the palace didn't earn Governor Tryon much favor from colonists due to the heavy taxes that were levied to pay for the elaborate construction. The palace's namesake departed in June 1771 to become governor of New York. Hosiah Martin succeeded Tryon as royal governor of North Carolina and moved into the palace in August 1771. As revolutionary momentum mounted, Martin fled in May 1775. The palace endured tumultuous times and periods of disrepair during the American Revolution, but continued to serve as the setting for notable happenings. On January 16, 1777, Richard Caswell took the oath of office at Tryon Palace to become the first governor of the state of North Carolina. President George Washington attended a dinner and ball at the palace during a 1791 visit to New Bern. As the new capital neared completion in Raleigh in 1794, the state legislature met at Tryon Palace one final time. 4 years later, in February 1798, a fire started in the cellar where hay was stored. It spread into the main building and destroyed all but the kitchen and stable offices. New Bern moved on. George Street extended over the original palace site. A bridge spanned the Trent River. Houses rose from former palace grounds. The surviving West Wing became apartments. But stories of the palace endured, and some North Carolina citizens desired to see it reconstructed. In 1945, Governor Greg Cherry appointed the 25-member Tryon Palace Commission. With money from the state legislature, as well as a hefty donation from New Bern native Maud Moore Latham, restoration work began. Buildings were demolished or moved. U.S. Highway 70, including its bridge, was rerouted. The same architecture firm that restored Colonial Williamsburg took on the project. John Hawkes' original plans for the palace guided the structure's second coming. On April 8, 1959, Tryon Palace held a grand reopening. Due to its broken timeline, the palace has two histories. One is the long arc, stretching back to North Carolina's colonial days. The other is the history of the current structure, which has now been the palace for 63 years, significantly longer than the original, which stood for almost 28. 20 years after the reconstructed palace opened, it hosted the first Candlelight Christmas celebration. While attendees expect certain hallmarks annually, dancers in the council chambers, period costumes, and black powder fireworks, other details change every year. Candlelight is a tradition in its own right, says Hadley Sherris, the gardens and greenhouse manager who oversees palace decor inside and out. The event is as much a tradition as this physical place. Sherris and her team have evolving discussions about how to portray the palace for the holidays. Last year, they chose a botanical theme. During the second half of the 18th century, society, especially the upper class, became fascinated with botany. Queen Charlotte of Mecklenburg's Strelitz particularly enjoyed studying plants, so the palace's council chambers were decorated in her honor. Birds of paradise, whose scientific name, Strelitzia reginae, honors the queen. festooned the mantel and door casings. The grand staircase sported a Tree of Life motif. As Sherris tours visitors through the palace, she repeatedly stresses that the decor is not true to the time period. Although the decorations tell a story of what was happening in the world during a certain era, what we see in the palace today is highly overstated. We did decorations that were period correct 1 year, and people asked if we had budget issues, Sherris said. To understand how lavish things were, we have to step up things to translate to today's audience. Small bits of native greenery, as suggested by the carol The Holly and the Ivy, would have been the focus for door frames, mantels, and tables. No one would have wasted precious candles by setting them in windows. Citrus fruits, commonly used in wreaths and garlands today, were extremely expensive. If you could have afforded to ship in fruit and then put it on the wall, people would have questioned your sanity, Sherris says with a grin. In an effort to communicate the governor's status and prominence, staff members go over the top, but they are clear about what is true to history and what is exaggerated. Candlelight attendees come to see grandeur and finery, which is expected for the state's first family, but palace staff want them to understand how modern amenities skew our idea of what the past was actually like. The John Kuno tradition was added to candlelight in 1999. Enslaved Africans practiced this Christmastide celebration, also known as John Coonering or John Coonering, where they expressed the culture of their homeland through costumes, music, and dance. The single day of celebration provided a reprieve from slave labor and a loosening of social constructs. Enslaved men and women were allowed to greet their masters at the front door, to visit neighboring plantations, and to release pent-up frustration through song and dance. Today at Tryon Palace, John Kuno involves a core group of 7 characters and 25 to 30 community members who join for drumming and dancing. Local groups from churches and schools take part in the tradition. For enslaved people, John Kuno was the only day that they could celebrate where they came from, says Sharon C. Bryant, the African-American outreach coordinator at Tryon Palace, who oversees John Kuno. John Kuno likely first appeared in Jamaica during colonial times and spread through the Caribbean islands. In the North American colonies, John Kuno was largely found in North Carolina. Although no records indicate that John Kuno took place in New Bern, historical accounts show that the tradition was practiced in Edenton and at Somerset Palace in the 1820s and in Wilmington in the mid-1800s. Today, candlelight attendees particularly enjoy the ragman character. The multicolored costume, made entirely of scraps of cloth, wriggles and waves as the man or woman dances to the drumbeat. Each rag represents a member of his or her family. When he or she put on that costume, it reminds me of an eagle soaring in the air, Bryant says. It's a spirit roaming around us, roaming free. Another important part of the candlelight storyline is the culinary tradition. Servants work tirelessly to prepare elaborate dishes for the governor's table. As you read through cookbooks of the time period, you start figuring out, oh, so this is going to take a very long time, says Matt Arthur, Tryon's Living History Program coordinator. We think a gelatin dessert is easy. It's just a box of Jell-O and boiling water. Back then, they were boiling calves' feet, going through a purification process using bladders of freshwater fish and deer antlers. It took a long time to do all that. Arthur considers any 1700s recipe that involves gelatin to be a power flex. Those dishes demonstrated to the governor's dinner guests that he had enough servants to pull off such complicated recipes. Food was a way for people of stature to show how wealthy they were without saying. Sweets are another example. Sugar was expensive. A holiday table filled with sweet treats such as marzipan, punch, Jordan almonds, chocolate tarts, and gingerbread meant that the host family was doing very well. During candlelight tours, no cooking takes place in the hearth room. In keeping with the first-person spirit of the evening, those preparations would have been completed hours before the event. But visitors who tour the palace on any other day during the holiday season are sure to see seasonal specialties like gingerbread or wassail in progress. Each year, the challenge of telling stories of the past gets harder. The world continues to shrink. We can tour the globe with devices in the palms of our hands. It's impossible to forget what we know now and place ourselves 250 years ago in the daily lives of colonists and enslaved people who found themselves in an unfamiliar place, disconnected from family, friends, and customs. But historic sites across the state keep trying. This month, interpreters at Tryon Palace tell another 250-year-old holiday story in a reconstructed 60-year-old building. They bend the rules of society to better communicate the big picture. Guests of the governor never would have been invited into the cellar where the rum was stored and servants slept, but those servants had stories too. And for most of us, our social status more closely mirrors those servants, then the elite ruling class. If we try to understand what it took for them to turn fibers into thread using a spinning wheel or ease a toothache with a swig of rum or spend the better part of a winter day in total darkness, we will appreciate their contributions to the conveniences that we enjoy today. These stories help hook in others, new guests, and the next generation of museum professionals, Arthur says. That's how we continue to breathe new life into our past. Tryon Palace is on South Front Street in New Bern. They have a website, of course, tryonpalace.org. And now, let there be peace. During the Civil War, Christmas became a season of longing for soldiers and their loved ones waiting at home. Written by Philip Gerard. There is a wood engraving here on the right-hand side. A man is bending over, kissing his wife, who has a floor-length dress and, a bustle in it, puffed out in her unnaturally thin waist, and she's got her arms around her husband, and there's a little girl looking very sad off to one side, holding a doll, and there's a boy hanging on the leg of the man, and he's holding the young boy's hands, and there's another couple at the door, and two of their children are there. There's a toy gun on the floor and a tipped-over wooden horse on wheels, and the gentleman's cap is on the floor on a pillow and a Christmas tree in the background on a table. And the caption says, "Furlough, Christmas, 1863. A wood engraving in the style of political cartoonist Thomas Nast captured the heartache of families separated by the Civil War and the joy they felt when they were reunited. As North Carolina troops march off to war in the spring of 1861, their leaders repeat an old lie. They will be home for Christmas. The first volunteers enlist for just 6 to 12 months. The first Christmas of the war is celebrated in traditional ways on the home front. At mansions such as that of John D. Bellamy in Wellington, wreaths might be hung over mirrors and mantels and garlands draped from the high brass gasoliers. Children's stockings adorn the fireplaces, their presents of toys and candy hung on the tabletop, cedar, or pine tree. Early in the war, Christmas feasts are sumptuous. The Bellamy's wealthy neighbors, the John Taylor family, host friends in their Greek Revival mansion, offering a menu of duck, oyster, turkey, country ham, Irish potatoes, brandy peaches, and five kinds of pies. A popular carol is sung in parlors and by outdoor revelers. The one-horse open sleigh, also called Jingle Bells, written by secessionist James Pierpoint in 1857. On plantations such as Somerset near the Great Dismal Swamp, enslaved people enjoy a rare respite from labors ranging from a single day to a whole week. To keep them from running away in fear of January 1st, the traditional date for hiring out or selling off slaves, they receive gifts of food, money, or liquor. Some feasts on hogs and wild game, and selected men sing and parade in costume for John Connu, a celebration that allows them, for a brief period, to mock their enslavers and break the monotony of their captivity. Harriet Jacobs, who hid out in a crawl space in Edenton for 7 years before finding her way to freedom in 1842, writes, "Every child rises early on Christmas morning to see the Johnconos. Without them, Christmas would be shorn of its greatest attraction." But in thousands of households across the state, the holiday is now transformed by one brutal fact. Tens of thousands of fathers, sons, and brothers are away at war. During the course of the war, some 130,000 North Carolina men serve in the Confederate forces, and another 8,000 or more white and black soldiers serve in U.S. regiments. Never in living memory have so many men been absent from their homes for so long. Some 30,000 of those absences made permanent by disease or death in battle. By fall of 1862, all men aged 18 to 45 were eligible for Confederate conscription, the draft, for 3 years or the duration of the conflict. It has been just a generation since Christmas was popularized by Charles Dickens' A Christmas Carol. In that time, the holiday has evolved from its status as an important date on the Christian calendar to a day dedicated to gift-giving, a shared family meal, and prayers for peace on earth. Now Christmas assumes a new poignancy, hollowed out by absence, infused with sentimental longing. In the North and South, it becomes for many the most significant family celebration of the year. The tradition extends to African Americans in Washington, liberated by the presence of Union soldiers who arrange tables in a vacant store and serve U.S. soldiers and sailors a Christmas Day 1862 feast of chicken, goose, duck, and other local fare. In 1863, Thomas Nast, a cartoonist for Harper's Weekly, creates the modern image of Santa Claus as a jolly, rotund figure. Santa Claus in cap shows the white bearded elf handing out presents to U.S. soldiers, clearly a Union man. Some of those troops stationed in the Washington County town of Plymouth celebrate that year with a rowing match between the crews of two gunboats. In a letter to the New Bern Times, a soldier identified as Kappa reports, "The night before Christmas was ushered in by an illumination of the headquarters and hospital of the 85th New York. From the ceiling were suspended rustic chandeliers, twined with sprigs of evergreen, and interspersed here and there clusters of wild fruits of the woods of all colors, vying with art itself. Such handicraft we thought must be the work of the fairies." Second Lieutenant John F. Sink, Company A, 42nd North Carolina, posted with his regiment to Wilmington on Christmas Day 1863, writes a gloomier report to his uncle Michael Sink of Lexington. "Uncle, this is the third Christmas that I have spent in the service of our country, and I am getting tired of it. But complaining is no good. I hope I will live to see another Christmas pass, but I do want to get out of this troublesome war." The bitter winter of 1864, likely to be the final Christmas of the war, ushered in a new carol, Santa Claus, now known as Up on the Housetop, penned by Benjamin Hanby, an Ohio abolitionist whose family is said to be part of the Underground Railroad. On December 5th, Daniel H. Dellinger writes to his wife from Salisbury, "Dear wife and children, I should like to come home and see you all, but I can't get no time now when I can come home. I don't see any prospect of our getting off as long as they keep these Yankees here. But there is one thing that is sure, and that is starvation will disband us all, and that before another year." In most households throughout the state, there are no store-bought presents. Santa, some children are told, is being kept away by the Yankees, maybe even shot. Mary McCrimmon offers a bitter poem titled Santa Claus, in which she writes, "This happened one Christmas, I'm sorry to write. Our ports are blockaded, and Santa tonight will hardly get down here. For if he should start, the Yankees would get him, unless he was smart." Neither the troops in the field nor the civilians at home enjoyed much feasting. Lieutenant Sink returns to Battery Anderson, south of Wilmington, with the 42nd North Carolina Regiment in boxcars in below-freezing weather on December 23rd, just in time for battle. The Wilmington Soldiers' Aid Society has arranged for Christmas dinner at the railroad depot. Now it hurriedly ships the precious turkeys, hams, potatoes, and other foods to Fort Fisher. On Christmas morning, at St. James Episcopal Church in Wilmington, the congregation's hymns are punctuated by the booming salvos of cannon fire from the great U.S. Navy Armada bombarding Fort Fisher at its southern sea face. At the end of the war, we'll align with another Christmas holiday, Easter. President Abraham Lincoln will be assassinated on Good Friday. 12 days later, on April 26, 1865, when General Joseph E. Johnson surrenders some 90,000 soldiers to General William D. Sherman at Bennett Place near Durham, the Union will be resurrected. For now, soldiers and civilians alike endure one last Christmas of war. For too many, a bleak season of privation and battle that seems to mock the very idea of peace on earth and goodwill toward men. But others see a ray of hope in the old tradition and the story that inspired them of a man and his pregnant wife finding refuge in a rude stable along the road to redemption. And we just have about a minute and a half left. That's hardly time to read anything. I wonder about the back page, though. The back page is usually a picture. Well, the back page in this case says our state store, Stocking Stuffers, inspired by North Carolina. But maybe we'll find that image in here. Nope, not going to have one this time. It says, the best of our state celebrating North Carolina. Now you can watch classic episodes of our state's 17-time award-winning television show on PBS North Carolina. From across North Carolina, these treasured stories are straight from the pages of Our State magazine, Reimagined. Thursday nights at 8 p.m. on PBS North Carolina. There was an ad for the best of our state at Pinehurst in January, but there's a big red banner across the upper right which says sold out. They do have a store. They'd like to sell you things. There's some shown here. A Fraser fir candle for $15. Wooden beaded snowflake ornament, $18. Nutcracker notepad for $18. Mulling spices for $7. And assorted candy sticks for $12. You can find out more at ourstatestore.com or call them at 800-948-1409. Well, that's all the time we have for today's episode of Our State Magazine. Hope you enjoyed it and that you'll be sure to listen next time. I'm Fred Brack, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Today's reading of Our State Magazine was underwritten by the Carter Glass Insurance Agency, serving the community since 1974. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Our State Magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. Cause questions, comments, call the studios, 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, and happy holidays to all.